Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Laura Cuddy. Thank you, Laura. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi there, and welcome to this webinar looking at dealing with urinary emergencies, which are fairly common emergency presentations in our pets. And so what we're going to discuss today is what constitutes a urinary emergency as such. And really, it boils down to the inability to excrete urine to the outside, whether that be that you are producing urine normally and you can't get it out the urethral orifice, or whether it be that you have urine leakage or something along those lines that's resulting in you accumulating waste products inside the body. In this webinar, we're not going to focus on diseases or conditions that may result in you not producing urine at all, such as acute renal failure. We're mostly focusing on more surgical conditions over the next hour. So the specific conditions we'll try to focus on today include feline lower urinary tract disease, or blocked cats, urolithiasis, which is going to be our main reason for blocked dogs, of course. We're also going to discuss urethral trauma, ruptured urinary bladder or uroperitoneum, and urethral obstruction. Really, the general approach to any of these cases remains very similar in the fact that we are not excreting the waste products we need to. And so many of these patients present with similar cardiovascular and metabolic derangements, no matter which of these conditions they happen to have. And so we'll start with the general approach to these patients before focusing on each specific condition. So we'll discuss the assessment and stabilization, how we localize the actual lesion and get a diagnosis, decision making, really the tough part as regards is intervention required, and if so, when is intervention required? And lastly, what surgical options are there in the immediate term that might be performed in an emergency setting, and also when we're talking for long-term management of these patients, so the clients are aware what costs and other implications may be in for the pet's future. So let's look at assessment and stabilization. The first thing we're going to want to do is to evaluate and correct the hemodynamic status. Then we're going to want to assess and correct metabolic derangements. We're going to, once the patient is somewhat more stable, want to deal with the source of accumulated urine if present. And then we're probably going to have to perform some type of temporary or permanent urinary diversion. So let's look at these in a bit more detail. Hemodynamic status is probably the most important thing we need to assess when these patients come in the door. These patients may be very stable if this is a fairly recent injury. It takes quite a while for these metabolites to build up, or it may be that they are excreting some urine, just not enough. Or they may be very unstable. You know, your typical two-day blocked cat is typically not in great shape when they come in the door. And so we're going to assess them like we would any other patient. We're going to gain IV access as soon as we can. We're going to perform some blood work, typically a PCV, total solids, a blood gas, maybe hematology chemistry if indicated, not indicated in all patients. But we at least need a baseline of their BUN, creatinine, potassium, etc. We want at least a blood pressure if we could get it. In blocked cats, for sure, a temperature, because we know hypothermia is actually a pathologic process in these guys as well due to dysregulation of their set point. And then we're going to try and get intravenous fluids in as quickly as we can, really. We depends on how unstable the patient is. It may be that we choose to use bolus fractions of shock doses. It may be that they don't need that, that they simply need you to assess their dehydration, correct that, and provide a maintenance fluid requirement. And there aren't very good guidelines as to how much fluids we should be giving these patients, if we should be trying to diurese them or just simply correcting their dehydration and adding their maintenance to it. There also are not great guidelines on what's the most appropriate fluid to use to correct these patients. So we know they have a lot of metabolic disturbances. And so typically in our clinics, we'll either have sodium chloride or we'll have lactated Ringer solution. On one hand, sodium chloride has a greater dilution effect on potassium because it doesn't contain any potassium, whereas lactated Ringer's does contain a very small amount of potassium. However, sodium chloride is acidifying and we know acidosis is a problem in these patients, whereas LRS would be alkalinizing. And so the question is the potassium in the LRS relevant or not? It's a very small amount, 4 to 5 milliequivalents per liter. What we know based on experimental studies in both experimental cats and in clinical cases is that it doesn't appear to be very relevant. Yes, we know that maybe if we use LRS, we will have slightly more efficient restoration of the acid-base balance and electrolyte balance. But to be honest, when you look at clinical outcomes, it's likely of no clinical relevance which fluid you choose to use. So as we mentioned previously, the metabolic derangements include metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, azotemia, ionized hypocalcemia, which currently we don't pay probably enough attention to, and hyperphosphatemia. So the main ones we pay attention to are going to be the metabolic acidosis, the hyperkalemia, and the azotemia. And they are the end goals for our fluid resuscitation and our urine drainage. Are we making inroads into these changes in metabolic function? Hyperkalemia is going to be the main one that we worry about. And the reason for that is when we have increased potassium levels in the extracellular fluid, we have the decreased concentration gradient for potassium across the myocyte. And so we have a decreased resting membrane potential of the myocyte. So typically it should be minus 90, it might go to minus 80 or minus 70 millivolts. As the resting membrane becomes increasingly less negative, i.e. towards minus 70, then we have a problem in that we get prolongation of membrane depolarization, and so we get prolongation of the QRS complex. And so what we can end up with are quite a few cardiac rhythm disorders. And we can see in this diagram on the right-hand side, from the bottom to the top, we have increasing levels of potassium. And we can see some fairly specific changes in the ECG that would be characteristic of hyperkalemia. What's very interesting is, based on experimental work, in theory, in each band of hyperkalemia, we should have a specific change to the ECG. So starting with just a small degree of hyperkalemia, we might just have spiked T waves. Then we go to a decreased R wave amplitude, prolonged QRS. Then we move up to decreased P wave amplitude and increased duration. We can go to lack of P waves completely, and then we can go at very high levels of potassium to very wide and irregular looking QRS complexes and even ventricular flutter, fibrillation, or asystole. And so if you go and read any textbook, these will tell you, based on your potassium level, these are the changes you should be seeing on ECG. What's very interesting is if you look at clinical cases with hyperkalemia, in this retrospective study from 2008, they looked retrospectively at 15 dogs and 22 cats who had hyperkalemia for a clinical reason. And what they found was that 59% of ECGs were normal or had abnormalities that would not necessarily traditionally be considered part of the hyperkalemic response. And so what they noticed, we know that bradycardia would be one of the main things we would look for. They said there's a fairly weak correlation between the potassium blood level and heart rate in cats. And overall, we could say from clinically ill dogs and cats with hyperkalemia, the ECGs that we see are not consistent with those from experimentally induced hyperkalemia. And so their theory to this was, there may be other biochemical abnormalities in diseased animals which may result in these different ECG abnormalities to what we would expect. So the take home from this really is that yes, we should be looking at an ECG if we're concerned. We should be treating hyperkalemia, but it won't always follow these textbook rhythms that we see within these very, very narrow bands that we prescribe with these ECG abnormalities. So how are we going to treat hyperkalemia? Well, one option is to give insulin with dextrose, and the theory behind this is that insulin will stimulate the movement of glucose and potassium into the cells by stimulating the sodium potassium ATPase activity in skeletal muscle. And so this is one of the main treatments that we use for hyperkalemia. And typically we say 0.5 units per kilo of regular insulin, and for every unit of insulin, 2 grams of dextrose. But it's very important to dilute that dextrose. We wouldn't give 50% dextrose IV for obvious reasons. The next option is to give dextrose alone. And certainly that can be done, but you'll see here in the comments on the right-hand side, they don't do this in people because you don't get the same rise in endogenous levels of insulin, so you're not going to see the same effect. So the best practice would be to give insulin and dextrose together rather than relying on dextrose alone to drive that potassium into the cells. Terbutaline, I'm just going to mention because some people may or may not be using it or have heard of it, it stimulates sodium-potassium ATPase activity. It's a beta 2 agonist, and this is not recommended in people, and certainly I have not seen this used in our small animal patients either. Bicarb is a little bit controversial. We know that by improving the acidosis, we will indirectly cause a shift of the potassium into the cells. And so certainly we can give bicarb, but it wouldn't be my first-line therapy. I would prefer to treat the hyperkalemia, use my fluid therapy, and then see if my acidosis is improving. And only if my acidosis is severe and not improving will I consider giving bicarb. And lastly, most people will be quite familiar with giving calcium gluconate. And this is a great tool if you have a patient come in who's in fairly bad shape, has a lot of cardiac disturbances, because calcium gluconate is going to re-establish the normal gradient between the resting membrane and threshold potentials of the myocytes. And so by giving this, it's a cardioprotective agent, but you have to remember it is not going to fix your hyperkalemia. So it's not you have to use it with another tool, whether it be fluid therapy or whether it be with insulin and dextrose. So it's a great tool to temporarily protect the heart while you're lowering the potassium with other methods. So how would I approach this practically then? So if I had a bradycardia, or if my potassium was quite severely elevated, I would probably go ahead and give my calcium gluconate. You can give it over 5 to 10 minutes, just monitoring the ECG as you're doing it. And I would probably go ahead and give insulin and dextrose also. The other option is just to give, if the patient is particularly compromised in the cardiovascular system, is to rehydrate them and measure the potassium after you have given some fluid boluses and see how much inroads you've made into it prior to giving the insulin and dextrose. How do we go about treating the acidosis? I've already mentioned sodium bicarbonate. I think it's important not to rush in to give sodium bicarbonate because it's not the most straightforward drug to give. And so it's important to fluid resuscitate them first. And then if you continue to have a bradyarrhythmia or you continue to have quite severe acidosis or very low bicarb, then you might consider supplementing. And in theory, you should measure exactly how much bicarb you need to give by calculating the deficit, but more practically, we're realistically going to give 1 to 2 milliequivalents per kilo, and we're going to administer that over 15 minutes. But again, you have to be quite cautious with administering bicarb. Now we may have the patient somewhat better stable, we can start to concentrate on getting rid of what is causing all of these metabolic derangements. So we don't want to rush in and do that, but we need to do it fairly quickly, or else the metabolic derangements are simply going to come back again. And so it might be as simple as temporarily draining urine. It may be that we just pass a temporary urinary catheter and drain the bladder, for example, or we might, relieve a urinary blockage, and we simply might leave that catheter in as a more temporary solution, or we might just pass it the one time. If we can't do that or we have another reason, we might just simply perform a cystocentesis. Or in the case of a uroabdomen, we might go ahead and drain the abdomen of urine. And that can be enough to temporarily buy us some time to get the patient a bit more stable for definitive intervention. So when we're talking about passing catheters, we'll talk about this a bit later too, but there are loads of options out there. And clinics tend to stock one or two of these options, but it's important to remember there are many of them. I think the key here is to remember that each French is about 1 millimetre is about 3 French. And so a 12 French catheter is going to be about a 4 millimetre external diameter. So when you're choosing your size, you want to get the optimal size, especially if you're trying to retropull stones, but you don't want to damage the urethra. So you may have to use several different sizes to get this right. In female dogs, as a general guideline, depending on the size of the dog, we could be talking 3.5 to 14 French. But in male dogs, we could be talking up to 10 French. And of course, in male dogs, these catheters tend to be longer because we have a much longer stretch to get around through the penis, up around the ischial arches to get into the bladder. So of course, those catheters are usually a bit longer. You can use catheters made from silicone, made from latex, made from red rubber, as we can see, or polyvinyl. You can see this in the top right-hand picture, or plastic. Realistically, it depends on if you're using this for temporary solution or if you're planning to leave it in for a little while, because the silicone ones are the most comfortable and for sure probably the best ones if we're going to be leaving them in, and whereas the rigid plastic ones are not suitable for long-term use. So they're okay if you're simply doing a quick drainage and taking it straight back out again, but may not be suitable, as I said, for long-term diversion. And so certainly lots of options out there. In cats, again, we have loads of options, and again, it'll somewhat depend on what you stock in your clinic. Everyone should be quite familiar with the top catheter, which is the Tomcat catheter. This is made from polypropylene. Most of these catheters are going to be open-ended catheters, and we're going to use these to both unblock the cat and then provide temporary urinary diversion. The Tomcat, as the polypropylene catheter, is excellent for providing an ability to unblock a cat because it's fairly rigid. However, it's not very comfortable or nice for the urethra to leave that in long term, and it's certainly very difficult to secure a Tomcat. There's no real obvious way to secure it in for a reason. Other options are polyvinyl or red rubber catheters again. But the more common ones you'll see are number C and D, which are PTFE or polyurethane compounds. And the advantage of those is they're reasonably stiff at room temperature, so you can use them to unblock a cat. But then once they warm up with body temperature, they become a bit more flexible, so you can actually leave them in as your more permanent solution. Say you're leaving the catheter in for 24 or 48 hours. These catheters are very fine to stay in, and they also don't cause a lot of tissue reactivity. So instead of unblocking with the Tomcat and then having to replace another catheter, in theory you could unblock with these two bottom catheters and leave them in, and that would result in less urethral damage. Catheter size is important, especially when you're unblocking cats, and we'll talk a bit about this later. We've all been taught, and I certainly was taught, use the biggest catheter you can fit. So typically a 5 French catheter in a cat would be fairly decent size. More recent studies in cats with urinary obstructions due to a feline lower urinary tract disease have shown that actually they have an increased risk of reobstruction with the larger catheters than with the smaller ones. And whether that's due to urethral trauma, putting them in, who knows, but it's certainly the smaller catheters may be sufficient in these patients, the 3.5 French. So temporary urinary diversion may be necessary to get the patient more stable, to get them ready for surgery, or maybe you don't want to perform the surgery because you don't feel comfortable or you don't have the equipment, or the patient simply isn't ready for it. And so in that case, we're going to continue to need to divert urine until we get them ready for a definitive surgery. And so that might be leaving that urinary catheter in, as we mentioned already, connecting it up to a closed collection system. We don't like to see any open urinary systems anymore. Then the other option, if we can't pass a catheter, or for whatever reason, if we feel that cystocentesis is all that's indicated and we need the urine sample anyway, that is another option, repeated cystocentesis. And we'll talk about the pros and cons again of that later. And then lastly, it might be we can't pass a urinary catheter, or for whatever reason, the cystostomy tube is the indicated and preferred way of diverting. And that's certainly another temporary or permanent option for these patients. So let's talk a little bit about diagnostics, and really we're only going to use images to do that because we could go and spend a lot of time on diagnostics if we wanted to. But a lot of these diagnostics can be done with tools that are very readily available in your practices, because the urinary system is still probably best imaged using x-ray, using contrast x-ray, and using ultrasound. And so while we're starting to use advanced imaging techniques, they certainly aren't the be-all and end-all for these conditions. And so it might be that on a plain radiograph, we get a very easy answer. And so in this dog, we can see uroliths, and there's one in the typical location just at the level of the os penis. And then, of course, we can see a couple in the bladder. This radiographic positioning is what I would call the butt shot, and it's very important in a male dog. You get this shot where you pull the hind limbs forward to expose the urethra as it travels up behind the tuberosity and then curves around, because often you can have urolithes there that are superimposed by the femurs unless you perform this shot. So as well as my plain radiographs, I would always perform this shot as well. And it might be that we see urethroliths. This is a cat where we can see multiple urethroliths present in the ureters. It might be that we just see, for example, a large amount of fluid accumulation. So this is evidenced by just very decreased serosal detail and consistent with peritoneal effusion. And we know that radiographs really only detect fluid at around greater than 1.8 mil per kilo. So if we have a very obvious bladder rupture, then we're likely to be suspicious on X-ray. But if we only have a small amount of fluid accumulation, we may miss it on plain X-ray. Contrast studies are really helpful for the urinary system, and the most helpful one I find is a retrograde cyst urethrogram. So to perform this, we initially get our plain X-rays first. Then you will use contrast, a water-based soluble contrast, and you're going to use a catheter, and you can put the catheter into the bladder first and then inject the contrast as you withdraw the catheter, and either use fluoroscopy or multiple serial X-rays to see where you have either obstruction, as evidenced by a contrast filling deficit, or whether you have leakage, for example, from the urethra in the case of urethral trauma. And so typically we use positive contrast. Negative contrast can have its uses, but it, in most common day, everyday practice, positive contrast is what we go for. And you can see on this X-ray, we do have a gas bubble in the middle of that bladder. That's unintentional. We weren't going for double contrast here. It's just simply there happened to be a couple of bubbles in that syringe. So positive contrast usually gets us the answers we want. And we're looking for the outline of the urinary bladder, and then we're looking for the outline of the urethra the whole way down to see if we have any leakage of contrast in our filling defects. And so contrast can give you your diagnosis fairly easily. And so this is a case of a dog that was hit by a car 2 days prior to presentation, came in with large volume peritoneal effusion. We were very suspicious. We popped in this abdominal drain you can see on the radiograph temporarily to get her stable. And then we came back and did a retrograde cyst urethrogram the following day. And we can see the water-soluble contrast leaking into the peritoneal space from the apex of the bladder. Now you could argue, is that even necessary? We were fairly suspicious of a bladder rupture. But there are cases where, you know, the bladder is the only organ involved in about 56% of uroabdomens, but there are other parts of the urinary tract that may be involved, and you may not feel comfortable getting into, if we have urethral rupture or urethral rupture, you may not be comfortable getting into the surgery for that. So this can at least tell you it's just bladder. Yes, go ahead and go in and repair the bladder once the patient is stable. And then we can, of course, see urine leakage. We can see just a small area of this. This is obviously an inverted image, so the black is appearing as contrast in this image. And we can see a little leakage, not in the normal location of the bladder in this guy. And this happened to be just from the ventral aspect of the bladder. Excretory urograms can be useful. I have to say, in my practice, on an emergent basis, I don't use these terribly often, but we can use them to highlight the renal pelvis and to look at the ureters. And in this image on the right-hand side, we can see an urethral obstruction on the left kidney and ureter. Ultrasound still remains really helpful for the urinary tract. And so we can, in this image of the bladder, we can see the hypoechoic fluid within the bladder. We can see the bladder walls, which look a little bit thickened. And then outside of the bladder at the apex, we can see a hyperechoic structure, which turned out to be a blood clot. And this is that same case I showed you with the rupture of the apex of the bladder. And we can see anechoic free fluid around that area in the peritoneal space. And so certainly ultrasound remains very good for looking for free fluid and examining all of the structures of the urinary tract that are within the abdomen. More challenging when we get to the urethra, of course. Ultrasound remains the mainstay, really, of looking at cats with urethroliths, and we can assess the degree of hydronephrosis. We can see whether we actually can identify urethroliths and whether we do have backup with hydronephrosis related to that, or even pelvic dilation of the kidney. And this can help with decision making with these patients. Advanced imaging I have used more recently for some of my urinary patients, but it tends to give almost more questions than answers. This is a case that presented with urethroliths and turned out that it actually had a proliferative mass at the trigone of the bladder. And so the question was, which disease is the most pertinent to this case? And so sometimes it can be a very helpful modality, and other times it can bring more questions than we expected it to. So now let's move on to some specific conditions in our patients that we see quite commonly on an emergency basis. So to refresh, we're going to cover feline lower urinary tract disease. We're going to cover urolithiasis, ruptured urinary bladder or uroperitoneum, urethral trauma, and briefly urethral obstruction. Some degree of knowledge of these conditions is assumed, and we won't go through each condition from step one all the way to the end. We'll assume that you're dealing with these cases on a fairly regular basis and have some knowledge of how they present. So most people have probably found themselves in this situation with a cat that comes in the door and it's fairly moribund, and the owner reports it's straining to urinate and has been, maybe for a day, maybe less. And when they come in, you can palpate a very large, distended bladder. And certainly you are concerned that the most likely diagnosis is going to be feline lower urinary tract disease resulting in urethral obstruction. Now, when this first was described, we originally thought that most of this was due to mucus plugs or stones or other physical barriers that were preventing urine from being excreted down the urethra. However, more recent studies suggest that this is more likely going to be due to a spasm of the urethra, a spasm of the smooth muscle, resulting in a functional obstruction rather than a mechanical obstruction. And so the thinking of this has changed a lot. And so we don't commonly expect to find urolithes, although the odd case we do. Sometimes we see mucus plugs, but many times this is simply urethral spasm, and this is likely related to feline idiopathic cystitis or feline lower urinary tract disease. And so the priorities in these cases is, number one, again, going back to our algorithm, is seeing where they lie on the cardiovascular scale. And many of these may not have been noticed for a little while, and often they may have severe cardiovascular compromise. And so in these cases, we're going to want to get them stable before we do a whole pile with them. And then we're going to want to provide temporary diversion. And most of us will go ahead and pass a urinary catheter, preferentially either a Tomcat or one of those other catheters that we may leave in a bit longer. And we can do this typically with ketamine and Valium or under like GA of some other description, or if they're very moribund, we might simply use hydromorphone or methadone with diazepam. And typically, as we mentioned before, we can try and get that urinary catheter passed. That will allow us to continue to stabilize the patient before deciding what we're going to do with them over the next 24 or 48 hours. As I mentioned previously, the school of thought now, maybe we should consider smaller gauge catheters than the 5 Frenches I would typically be putting in. And so just something to bear in mind. One thing I found very helpful, I was working with a colleague in an emergency clinic, and I had not seen this done before, and he was doing this with all of his blocked cats, and I thought it was a very neat technique, which is a coccygeal epidural. And what that is that you perform an epidural right at the kind of sacrococcygeal junction. So it's a coccygeal epidural block, and by injecting lidocaine into the epidural space in this location, it results in anesthesia to the caudal part of the cat within 5 minutes, and it lasts for about 60 minutes. And what it's doing is producing anesthesia to the perineum, the penis, the urethra, the colon, and the anus by blocking the pudendal nerves, the pelvic nerves, and the caudal nerves. But there's no loss of motor function to the hind limbs. So essentially, we're almost going for the area where we'd see tail pull injuries. We're causing all of that to have a temporary anesthetic. And the nice thing about this is if we particularly have quite a moribund cat, You can potentially do this on a very moribund, unsedated patient or a lightly sedated patient, and it means you may not have to do a full GA in order to get your catheter in. So just a very neat little technique that can be used in a very practical setting. One thing I wanted to mention once you get your urinary catheter in is this survey that was published in 2015 in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery, and just talking about our standards of care and what we should be doing with these urinary catheters. Because one school of thought is we place these catheters, it's a first defense, many of these cats won't recur, and so we're going to leave the catheter in for maybe 24 or 48 hours depending on the patient, and then we're going to try and remove it and make sure they don't reobstruct. The issue with these patients and the ideal ways of dealing with the urethral catheter is that we should not be using antibiotics when the catheter is in place. Very few of these cats have urinary tract infections. We know that cat urine is fairly sterile. And even if they do, we should be treating these after the fact. So once the urinary catheter has been removed, we can take a sample of urine at that point. It's not really recommended to necessarily culture the catheter tip. It's better to get a cystocentesis sample or one through the catheter, or we can get them back in a few days and take a cystocentesis and see if there's a urinary tract infection that needs treating. And ideally, we should be doing that based on culture and susceptibility. The other thing I already mentioned is that we don't like to see these catheters open to the air, and so it's preferable if we can connect them up to a collection system. And that collection system might be as simple as an IV giving set connected to a drained fluid bag, or it might be one of these collection systems that you actually buy for that specific purpose. And that's the ideal way of doing it. It's also very important when you're putting the catheter in that you do a sterile prep of the prep use, that you wear sterile gloves and you try and handle the catheter in a fairly aseptic technique as best as you can when putting it in. And of course, whenever anyone's handling the catheter, they should be using hand hygiene and they should be wearing at least exam gloves when they're handling the catheter and performing urinary catheter care every few hours in the hospital. And interestingly, in this study, it found that we're not performing as well as we should when we're dealing with these. So 27% did not use antibiotics, but the vast majority of people are giving antibiotics with the urethral catheter in place. And number one, they're not necessary oftentimes. And number two, we could be promoting antibiotic resistance. The second one, the collection systems, again, the minority were using those. And ideally, we'd be using these in all patients. And that can be done fairly inexpensively. And of course, the sterile prep and the aseptic hand prep and gloves, again, were not very well done, and that's a fairly easy step to take. And interestingly, they found that more recent graduates performed better when they did the statistical analysis on this, that they tended to try and follow these rules as best they could. So just some points when we have these in the hospital, we don't want to introduce any more problems than we already have. Now comes the difficult part, and often this is where you may get somebody else involved, like a referral surgeon or somebody else more experienced if you're fairly new at dealing with some of these cases, is what if the catheter won't pass? And then you're kind of standing there thinking, how are you going to deal with this patient? So one simple option is just simply to do a decompressive cystocentesis, which is where you simply perform a cystocentesis and remove as much urine as you can. It allows you to get your urine sample that you can look at and do a urinalysis. And if you think it's indicated, you can also do a urine culture, not always indicated. The nice thing about this is it is very good for somebody who has a huge delay in that there's a lot of patients waiting to see them. They need to get this patient, but they just don't have the time to get the urinary catheter, or the urinary catheter won't pass, and they just need to buy the patient more time so they can get them more stable. So this is a very nice technique for those cases to temporarily provide relief of the urinary obstruction and buy you some time before it builds back up again. The other nice thing is it can actually help you to pass the urinary catheter. So if you drain the urine from the bladder, it can relieve some of that back pressure and it might allow you to pass the urinary catheter. So typically what I would do if it won't pass is decompress the bladder and reattempt to pass the urinary catheter again. If it still won't pass, then you're talking about other options here. And some things I have done, you can do percutaneous antegrade catheterization, or you can do open antegrade catheterization. I've done the open techniques, and I'll show some examples of what this is. But essentially, we go into the bladder and pass a guide wire from the bladder out through the urethra, out the urethral orifice, and then thread a catheter back in over that. And so that can be helpful in cases of urethral trauma, mostly where we just can't get the catheter to not keep going into the subcutaneous tissue. The other option I'll discuss shortly is an emergency cystostomy tube, and there are techniques described that can be used in the emergency room that are fairly straightforward and would certainly buy quite a bit of time before we decide the definitive treatment. And then lastly, I would try hard not to do these, but emergency perineal urethrostomy is another option, but I'd prefer if you could get some other urinary diversion in before resorting to doing the emergency perineal urethrostomy. That's better done on an elective basis if possible. So let's look at this decompressive cystocentesis. And as I mentioned, this can be a fairly controversial topic. The old school of thought being if you put a hole in a very distended, friable bladder, are you going to increase the risk of urine leakage or urinary bladder rupture later on? And so this study from 2015 decided to go and look at this. And in this veterinary hospital in the States, their protocol was that every patient had a decompressive cystocentesis first and then a urinary catheter was placed. And they reported 47 cats. So they used a 22 gauge, 1.5 inch needle. Then they would pass the urinary catheter. And the catheter was in for a median time of about 28 hours or so. They had a 91% survival to discharge, which would be fairly equivalent to most of these block cats on their first defense. Interestingly, quite a lot of these cats had peritoneal effusion, and most of the time it didn't need intervention. That was prior to doing anything with them, prior to even doing the cystocentesis. And I would say that's fairly common too, in that we see this peritoneal effusion, it tends to resolve. And interestingly, there was no resultant bladder rupture in any cat. And so the concerns regarding putting a hole in a friable distended bladder, as long as the bladder is not actively lacerated, the concerns about this are probably fairly unfounded. And certainly it would be a valid technique if there aren't great other options. And some people, of course, are using this to treat blocked cats, especially in cases that do not have great financial backing. You may choose to decompress them and send them home with pain relief and just decompress them every, you know, 2-3 times a day and hope that they relieve that obstruction themselves. So I mentioned this percutaneous antegrade urethral catheterization. So this can be done, but typically you're going to be relying on specialists available to do this. And so what you can do is pass a guide wire that we can see here in figure B. Pass the guide wire in C down the urethra, out the urethra, and then in D we can see a catheter being fed up over that guide wire and left in the bladder. And so this can also be performed open if you're stuck in order to get some kind of urinary diversion. I also mentioned the tube cystostomy, and this paper back in 2009 reported a case series of cats and dogs, and several of these were emergent cases where there wasn't another option. They couldn't get a urinary catheter, and so they performed this grid approach to the bladder. And in right lateral recumbency, if you go immediately cranial to that flank fold, you will find the bladder pretty much sits right there. So by doing a grid approach down through the muscles, you come on the urinary bladder, you simply tunnel the cystostomy tube down through into the body wall, into the bladder, and tack it into the bladder to the body wall, and then you have a fairly quick and easy cystostomy tube in place. And so certainly that is an option even for quite moribund patients, and it's a nice easy way of providing quite large-scale diversion. When would I consider permanent diversion in a blocked cat? And that's a very tricky situation. So we know that the recurrence rates in these guys, it depends who you read, but we can have fairly significant amounts of recurrence. And so the question is, at what point do we say enough is enough and that we need to go ahead and do a diversion in these patients? I would typically say they should be starting to think about a permanent diversion around the second offence, but definitely the third offence. And so we tend to see these serial blockers who keep coming in. And really, when you go through the cost of having to admit them, deal with the emergency scenario, place the urinary catheter and keep them in hospital realistically for at least 48 hours, the costs start to build up in these cases. And so certainly I would start to consider a permanent diversion at this point. The other thing to consider as well, if this cat blocks when the owner is not home, we could have a life-threatening scenario. And so with serial offenders, definitely the issue should be broached with the owners. So we know there's about a 30-40% reobstruction rate. A first offender, we generally try to give them a chance. Another reason for a permanent diversion might be an intractable obstruction, meaning that we can't pass a catheter no matter what we do, or we have an obstruction for whatever reason, that we neoplasia or a stone that we can't budge or something else, and we need to go ahead and do a permanent diversion for that patient. And lastly, as I mentioned already, finances, because these offences of coming in being blocked are quite costly. And so by the time you go and do a perineal urethrostomy, that's going to save the lifetime of having to deal with these issues. And so both welfare and financially, that can be a good outcome. And so when we talk about doing a urethrostomy, we have several locations we can do. We can do prepubic, subpubic, and transpelvic. We don't tend to talk about these locations very commonly because they are for more complicated cases where we have obstructions further up towards the bladder. In the vast majority of blocked cats, we're going to be talking about a perineal urethrostomy. And this is obviously a picture of a dog, so we're not going to have this extent of the penis. Really, what we're doing in the cat is amputating the penis and going and opposing the urethral orifice to the skin, so that essentially just distal to the anus, we will have a new stoma opening for that cat. So in cats, as I mentioned, it's almost always perineal. And then if we're stuck, we might do transpelvic, which is just immediately cranial to that, subpubic or prepubic. But the further up we go, the worse chance of a good outcome for that cat. So perineal urethrostomy by far is going to be the most common stoma site, and we can perform this in either sternal or dorsal recumbency. As I mentioned, this is not a surgery really that needs to be performed on an urgent basis unless the animal has an intractable obstruction, then we can't do anything else about it. And so some of you may be performing this surgery, but typically it's not necessary on an urgent method. We're talking kind of the day after or 2 days later maybe. But if you are, here are some tips and tricks. And so you can do this surgery. Typically, it was traditionally described in sternal recumbency. However, I prefer to do all of these in dorsal recumbency, because if you have the odd case that does have urolifts, then you can also access the bladder at the same time, which will allow you to remove the urolifts without having to change positioning and reprep the cat. And I also find this ergonomically more helpful for me, in that I'm not having to sit with my hands up for an hour doing a PU. I can simply stand, and it's a fairly quick approach. The anatomy is reversed, so you just need to be a bit cautious about your anatomy, that you don't get mixed up if you're used to doing it in sternal. What we want to do is dissect down the whole way to the retractor bulbi muscles. We're going to remove the retractor penis, and then we're going to make a little incision in the urethra. And then we're simply going to oppose the urethral mucosa to the skin. And it's very important you have mucosa skin apposition so that we get healing without granulation, because otherwise we will get stenosis of the orifice. It's also important whenever you're making a stoma of any description to make it bigger than the animal needs, because they shrink by about 50% over a few months. And one of the main complications we see is stenosis requiring revision. And that's because either the urethral mucosa wasn't dissected up far enough past the bulbourethral glands, or it wasn't freed up enough from the ventral aspect of the pubis, or it's a case that the orifice just simply wasn't made large enough or was allowed to granulate in. And so the end result, this is the cat in sternal again, we should see this orifice with a washboard down it to allow the urine to flow. And over time, that'll shrink drastically and be barely noticeable once the hair grows back. And what are the outcomes, just so owners are informed when they walk into the emergency room? Even if you're not performing PU yourself, you may be referring these patients on for PU. The outcomes are pretty good. And so we have fairly low mortality rates in the first few weeks and months. And so in the last first 2 weeks, kind of 6%. And then again, once we get beyond that point, fairly low rates. And that could be due to reocclusion, stricture, or recurrent feline lower urinary tract disease. It's very important to remind these owners this is not fixing the disease. It's simply stopping and getting rid of the most narrow part of the urethra. But they may still in future show signs of feline lower urinary tract disease, and so management of that must continue. So the median survival times are 3.5 years post-op. I would say, especially if you're doing this in slightly younger cats, you can expect fairly normal lives. About 11% have recurrent signs of feline lower urinary tract disease, but overall, most owners were quite happy that they had had this surgery done. And so, in general, this can be a life-saving and life-changing surgery for many of these cats. Complications I mentioned can be stenosis, we can have issues with tissue healing, and lastly, with the image on the right, we can have some disastrous outcomes. If we don't have good apposition of the mucosa to the skin, we can get extravasation of urine into the subcutaneous space, and urine is very caustic and can lead to sloughing of the entire perineum, which can be very difficult to deal with. So if you are doing these surgeries, it's very important that you really pay attention to your surgical technique. And also use magnification. It's a very small area, it's very important you get it right. The post-op care for these guys, you could argue about giving muscle relaxants, whether you give, generally if we do a PU we wouldn't, but if you've just passed a urinary catheter, it might be that you decide to give these guys smooth muscle relaxants in the hope of dealing with this functional obstruction. And at the moment, prazosin seems to be the most promising, even though we know that it doesn't necessarily have smooth muscle the whole way along the urethra. We know that if you give prazosin, it seems to be more effective than phenoxybenzamine, which has a longer onset of action anyway. The main thing we need to watch for in these guys, whether we do the PU or whether we have the urinary catheter in place, is that we can see post-obstructive diuresis. And this is well described in people. And we think it's because they accumulate substances within the bloodstream, osmotically active substances, leading to an osmotic diuresis. You can also have tubular dysfunction, medullary washout, ADH resistance, etc. And so there's all different components that can result in them not concentrating their urine properly in the immediate post-op period. And so we would categorize this as a urine output of over 2 mL per kilo per hour. It's been seen in about 46% of cats in the first 6 hours, and it can result in hypokalemia. So it's important to monitor the urine output, match the ins and outs, and if required, provide supplemental potassium. So let's move on to urolithiasis in dogs, which would be the main reason we see for urethral obstruction in dogs. We can also see neoplasia, and we can also see stricture, fibrosis, and some other weird and wonderful things. But on an emergency scenario, this would be a fairly common presentation. So what are our options? The ideal option is that we can retrohydropulse these stones back into the bladder and perform a cystotomy. And that way we don't need to go near the urethra. That would be great. Best case scenario. If we can't do that, we could talk about doing a urethrotomy. And if we can't do that, we may have to talk about permanent diversion, whether that be a urethrostomy or some other diversion depending on the location of the obstruction. So let's talk about retrograde urohydropulsion. And again, this is a technique probably most of you perform on a fairly regular basis. And so the key here is that we want to try and force these calculi to go back into the bladder. So by having a gloved assistant put pressure on the urethra per rectum, you can flush with the catheter and build up some pressure behind the stones. And as you flush, have them release their finger so that we get this pressure gradient that might force the stones back into the bladder. And then we can pass the urinary catheter and leave it in the bladder until we're ready to do something about those stones. So typically, it's best to do this under general anesthesia. You can try to do it under sedation, but often the patients aren't relaxed enough, and then we don't have enough relaxation of the urethra for it to be effective. You can use topical lidocaine to try and help. As I said, you can do your rectal exam to try and help to shift these stones a little bit or provide that pressure while you're back flushing it. You can also perform cystocentesis if you're worried that there's too much flush going in or the bladder is already quite full. And if you do that, of course, get samples for your analysis. And in this case, urine culture too. If we have stones, it's fairly likely we have some low-grade infection sitting on those stones. It may be that we're able to do avoiding urohydropulsion in cases with small amounts of stones, but usually these guys aren't presenting on emergency. These are incidental findings with small diameter stones and that aren't causing obstruction. They're just seen in the bladder, and we decide to get rid of them before they cause an obstruction. In general, we would say in female dogs, no greater than 4 millimetres, and in large male dogs, no greater than 3 millimetres, and we would try to pulse out. And certainly it's not a very common procedure, especially in the emergency scenario. And then, of course, we'll probably go ahead once we get the stones back into the bladder and perform a cystotomy. And it's up to you whether that's done on an emergent basis or whether it's done, for example, the following day. And as long as you have your urinary catheter in place, it takes the urgency out of it. And typically, we'll perform our cystotomy on the ventral aspect of the bladder. We'll have stay sutures in the apex of the bladder on either side. You can see this bladder is very thickened with a large amount of stones in it. And then often I do single layer closure using a short-acting absorbable suture material, a monofilament, such as monocryl or something like that. And then we can have cases that are more complicated. So we can see we've tried to pass the urinary catheter here, and certainly we have some stones in the bladder. But unfortunately, it looks like the urinary catheter has bypassed all of these stones sitting in the urethra. So our options here are to pass a bigger urinary catheter if we can. But if those stones won't move, we're now into the fact of having to do some kind of other diversion in this patient. So the option, well, it wouldn't be in that dog, there are too many stones, but we could, in theory, do a urethrotomy. And we do this by incising over the urethra and moving the stones. Some recent techniques have discussed doing this through the glans penis if you happen to have a stone at that location. And that way you end up doing this and not having to go through skin. You're just going through that mucosa and leaving it to heal by second intention. If you do a urethrotomy, the question is, should you close it or should you leave it open? And to be honest, it's really down to your preference, which you choose to do. If you decide to leave it open to heal by second intention, you can expect hemorrhage out of this site for about a week afterwards. And so you just tell the people to expect that. It's typically not life-threatening. Regardless of whether you close it or don't close it, stricture from these is fairly uncommon. Again, what if we are at that scenario where we have an obstruction that we can't deal with? Well, in dogs, we typically see one of those obstructions around the location of the os penis. And so in this case, the most common place for us to do urethrostomy in a dog is going to be a scrotal urethrostomy. And so this is where the urethra is most superficial and it's widest, and so we have our best chance of having a nice opening for the dog to urinate through. It also allows continued stone formation to come out through that stoma instead of continuing down through and again obstructing the os around the location of the os penis. So scrotal urethrostomy, if they're not castrated, they are castrated. We retract the muscle to the side, incise the urethra, and then we simply do this very nice mucosal apposition to the skin, just like we did for the cat. And then we end up with a stoma that looks something like what we can see here. So this patient also had a cystotomy, hence we have the abdominal incision as well. So we have a cystotomy to remove the stones, and then we have the scrotal urethrostomy. What about cases of urethral trauma? Urethral trauma is challenging. And for urethral healing to occur, we need two things. We need the mucosa to have some degree of continuity. It doesn't have to be circumferential, the continuity. It just has to have a little bit of continuity so that it can re-epithelialize and form its normal epithelial structure. And we also need it not to be exposed to urine because urine will delay healing. And so they're the two main things we need to think about whenever we have urethral trauma. So what are our options? Our options are, in most cases, we're fairly happy if it's only a, it's not a complete disruption, it's only a partial disruption. For example, a road traffic accident. We might be quite happy simply putting in an indwelling urinary catheter and leaving it in for about 7 days, diverting the urine and letting the mucosa regenerate. And that's usually a fairly successful technique. If we have a complete disruption, that's unlikely to be very successful, the indwelling urinary catheter, in which case we may need to go in and do a primary repair of the urethra. And lastly, it may be that that's not possible, and it might be that we need to go ahead and do a urethrostomy as a form of permanent urinary diversion. If we go back to cats that have urethral trauma, we know that trauma is the most common reason for urethral rupture in cats. And many of these cats in this institution were treated surgically, and many of them did just fine. If they've had an iatrogenic tear compared to a traumatic tear, they tended to do a little bit better. So briefly, I wanted to cover what are your other options as regards permanent permanent urinary diversion besides forming a urethrostomy. And the two other options are cystostomy tubes or urethral stenting. And we'll focus here on cystostomy tubes as they're more clinically relevant. A tube cystostomy can be performed really with any type of catheter, whether it be a Foley catheter, whether it be a mushroom-tipped gastrostomy tube or a low-profile gastrostomy tube. And they can all be used to do cystostomies. And what we want to do is form a skin incision off midline, so we can see this laparotomy. We're just off to the sides, incising through the skin. We'll form a purse string suture around close to the apex of the bladder. We'll form a purse string suture and then put a little stab incision into it. And then we'll insert the tube into that stab incision, tighten up the purse string, and then gently, with interrupted sutures, adhere the bladder to the body wall to form an adhesion. And so we can see that illustrated on the picture on the right-hand side on the schematic. And so what we end up with is this tube with a finger trap suture attaching it to the skin. And again, it's connected just like a urinary catheter would be to a closed collection system. What are the outcomes if you have to do this? Well, as we said, this may only be a short-term solution, or this may be a long-term solution, for example, in cases with neoplasia or other permanent obstructive lesions. And so what we know is that there's a reasonable amount of complications, and it tends to be in long-term patients, so we don't see as many complications in short-term patients. And the main thing to take from this is that many of these patients will actually continue to have this tube for a long time if they need it. Half of animals developed complications that were due to this cystostomy tube, and a lot of these were inadvertent removal or infection. However, most of these complications were fairly easily resolved. And so the owners have to be up for looking after this tube, but in general, this can be a life-saving technique that is not that morbid and can be dealt with fairly easily. So let's briefly touch on uroperitoneum. We saw this radiograph before from this patient that was hit by a car two days previously. And this would be a fairly common presentation, as we can see this hole in the apex of the bladder. But we can have non-traumatic ones too, such as urethral obstruction leading to backflow and resulting in pressure resulting in bladder rupture, bladder neoplasia, again, resulting in abnormal tissue under pressure, iatrogenic, the one we never like to hear, someone's expressing a bladder and they feel a pop, nobody likes to hear that one, or recent surgery, we may have a leakage from the cystotomy site potentially. And the diagnosis, really it boils down to, we say the creatinine, if it's 2 times more than that of blood, it would be diagnostic. But realistically, if it's anywhere more than the blood, it's suggestive. And the same for the potassium levels. So creatinine and potassium, if they're more than blood, we certainly would be concerned it's suggestive. And if it's over 2 times for creatinine and over 1.4 times for potassium, we would be certainly very suspicious of a uroabdomen. The thing about uroabdomen is it tends not to be a surgical emergency unless the animal happened to be fairly unlucky and had a urinary tract infection at the time of its injury, in which case I would treat that as a surgical emergency and go in and lavage the abdomen and treat it as a septic abdomen. So if it's not an emergency, what we can do is simply place a drain to drain the abdomen temporarily. And that's what we did in this RTA case, that it was 2 days in. Just to get her a bit more stable, we simply drained the abdomen and then came back and did her contrast studies and her bladder repair the next day. And bladder repair may be fairly straightforward. It might be a primary repair, or you might have significant bladder damage, in which case you might need to do a partial cystectomy. And luckily, the bladder is very forgiving with that, in that we tend to be able to resect a lot of it before we run into trouble. And the outcomes in these cases, what we found is in this study from Janet Grimes, that the bladder is responsible most of the time for uroabdomen. In some cases, the source was never found, or it was urethral or ureteral. And many of them survive and do well once they're treated appropriately. But there's no real risk factors that are shown to be predictive for non-survival. So lastly, we're briefly going to touch on ureteral obstruction because I feel like I am seeing more and more of these cases being sent for referral, and I think we're just doing a better job of diagnosing and dealing with these patients. And so it might be we see a cat that's just not feeling great, and we might see some changes in renal values, and you take these x-rays and you see these stones and you wonder if they are part of the problem, or does this cat have acute on chronic renal failure, or what is going on with these patients. So ureteral obstruction tends to be due to ureteral lithiasis. It tends to be due to calcium oxalate stones, which we know don't dissolve great medically. It tends to be seen in cats more than dogs, and they often have non-specific signs. You're not necessarily going to see urinary signs. You're just going to see not feeling well, vomiting, etc. The complicating factor is almost all of these cases have concurrent chronic kidney disease, and so we don't really know when we relieve a ureteral obstruction how well the kidney is going to recover from that. We do know the sooner we relieve the obstruction, the better the chance, but we don't know what underlying disease was there prior to the ureteral obstruction, and that complicates decision making for the owners. So definitely ultrasound is really helpful in these cases in looking at renal pelvic dilatation and also whether we have hydronephrosis, and also assessing where the urethroliths are and whether we can get at them in their location. There are several options here. I almost always try medical management, although we know it's not terribly successful. We could do a ureterotomy or a neo-ureterocystostomy, so reimplant the ureter if it's a very distal stone. We know this is fraught with complications due to the very small size of the feline ureter, so you're talking about needing an operating microscope for surgeries like that. We could do a ureteral nephrectomy. It's a pity to lose a kidney for this, especially if we're not sure of the other one's function. We could put a ureteral stent, very challenging procedure. Or more recently, we're doing a lot more of these subcutaneous ureteral bypasses, which we will talk about in just a second. So medical management, typically I would try for 24 hours unless there's a really big contraindication for it. So I would use aggressive intravenous fluid therapy, diuretics, pain relief. You can try amitriptyline and prazosin in the hope that it relaxes ureters enough and that these stones move down. A lot of the cases I found in my hands have multiple stones and the stones don't move or don't move enough, and many of them end up requiring surgery. And so typically the surgery we do now, instead of messing around with ureterotomies, etc., is we simply perform a subcutaneous ureteral bypass. And what this means is we place a pigtail catheter into the kidney, we connect it up into the subcutaneous space, and then connect another catheter into the bladder. And that gives us a port in the subcutaneous space here that allows us to access and flush these if they block, and to get samples for your analysis and culture. And so by connecting these two catheters with this port in the subcutaneous space, as I mentioned, it gives us that access that we need. And this is a fairly new procedure. The outcomes seem very promising for it, and it can be done bilaterally. And certainly it's simplifying how we treat these cats at the moment. So certainly something to think about for referral for these patients. And this is the end product. So this is one filled with contrast. We always do that to make sure that they're not leaking. So we have this catheter inserted into the kidney, connecting to this port in the subcutaneous space, and then connecting from there on into the bladder. And so the cat should urinate normally and essentially look like a normal cat from the outside. So what would be my take-home messages from this webinar? The key with any of these patients is they all present in a fairly similar way, and the key is they need to have stability of the cardiovascular system before we intervene too much. Intravenous fluids can do a lot for your metabolic derangements before you rush into giving drugs for hyperkalemia or giving bicarb for acidosis. I generally would, if they can tolerate it, try and deal with the intravenous fluids first. As soon as they're stable enough, try and either drain or provide some kind of urinary diversion, localize your lesion. And then think about, do you need to do surgery on that straight away, or would they benefit from a bit longer stabilization prior to subjecting them to an anesthetic? And I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laura for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.